taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Sangha. And welcome especially to Mary Duryea, our speaker today, the last Dharma talk of the year. Mary is a retired mediator and psychologist. She grew up in the Northwest and came to the Bay Area to attend school in 1967 and has been here ever since. She walked through the gate at BZC in 1993, received lay ordination from Sojin Mel Weitzman in 2004, was head student or shuso in 2017, sharing the abbot seat, and received lay entrustment in 2023 from Hozan Allen Sanoki. She is married to Libby and lives in Oakland. Please welcome Mary Duryea.
Thank you, Ross.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Greg and Linda and the Tanto Eno for inviting me today to speak. Thank you, and deep gratitude to Hozan Roshi, beloved teacher, friend, and older Dharma brother. And this was to be his talk today. The abbot gives the last talk of the year. So may this be a worthy offering. What a time we are in. Beginning sometime in November, I started getting the line of a poem kind of percolating up, and finally I went to look it up and realized that it had been a great comfort and talisman for me in these last weeks in this tender time. It goes like this. When despair for the world comes over me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, for fear of what my life and my children's lives will be, I go and lie down where the woodrake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel the day-blind stars above me waiting with their light for a time. I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Poem by Wendell Berry. For me, it's a poem about taking refuge. We took refuge this morning in our Bodhisattva ceremony. We took refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. For me, it's easy to imagine what it means to take refuge in Sangha. We have been so much doing that lately. My fall began with the death of my niece, who had been challenging cancer for 8 years. And her name was chanted for years here in the well-being ceremony, which was a refuge for all of us in the family. And we're taking refuge now. I mean, I'm a little astonished at how many people are here in this blustery winter day. We take refuge in being together, and certainly we took great refuge in our recent session. And it's easy for me to think about how we take refuge in Dharma. I've been relying on a text this fall, which I want to talk a bit about, but it's been a great comfort to me to study. And I see how that is a practice in daily life, as it's taking refuge in Sangha as a practice in daily life. So my question is, how do we take refuge in the Buddha? What exactly does that look like on a nitty-gritty day-to-day basis? Ozan is fond of saying, throw yourself into the house of Buddha, which always delighted me to hear, and then I followed it with this thought, like, how do I do that exactly? My literal mind is like, where's the door? Where's the house? What does that mean? One thing that helped me about the poem is, in taking refuge, part of taking refuge comes from the line of not taxing one's life with forethought of grief. This business of anticipatory grief, or anticipatory, certainly there's anticipatory fear. There was an essay that Earthling Manuel circulated right after, or the first week of November. And the line that caught me was a line about how anticipatory fear feeds fear. There's something about that that is helping me relocate in this moment, like pulling back on the catastrophic thinking and saying, okay, what's happening now? How are we now? How am I now? The other takeaway, I guess, that I take from the poem is in the phrase, for a time. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. That taking refuge is not a place to park oneself and stay. One needs to go back into the world. And I will confess that part of my taking refuge is that I haven't read a newspaper in 6 weeks. And I plan to continue that for the end of the rest of the year. But I know that I will need to tune back in. And that the practice that I have been working on, the edge that I have been working, is creating that inner stability. The inner stability that is not swayed by external circumstances. Not to say ignoring them, but not having one's, not being yanked around inside. So I'm turning to a text which is surprising to me, that I'm turning to. It's a text that I've had both an ambivalent and adverse reaction to in the past, but has sort of opened up, interestingly, as things like that happen in our practice, we go to another level. So the text is the five ranks, Namchan's five ranks. And the reason it has become alive to me is that Jerry picked the song of the Jhumara Samadhi as the teaching for our Sangha week at Tassajara, and embedded in that is a reference and a discussion of the five ranks. And in my preparation, I spent a lot of time right up until the last minute studying the Jhumara Samadhi, and then I thought, you know, maybe I could crack a book and see what the five ranks are about. I mean, my aversion is the idea of ranks, the stepping stone feeling of it, and I'm pleased to know that I'm in good company. Dogen didn't think much of the five ranks either. But there is a way, and it comes right from Dongchan, to read the five ranks not as a stepping stone of enlightenment, a progression, but as a series of descriptions of modes of experience, in each of which is enlightenment and realization. So I'm gonna give you the thumbnail. I'm not gonna go deep into the scholarship of it, but just to say that Dongchan was the 9th century. He's building on Sekito Kisen, who wrote the Sandokai. And we chant his name, Dongchan's name is Tozen Ryokai. After him comes Honshu, a couple hundred years, and then comes Dogen. So that's the string of ancestors. So other descriptions of it are that there are five perspectives of an indivisible reality. I don't know what Dzogchen thought about it. He taught it, and his teaching got captured by Charlie Pokorny in a very scholarly summary, so there is a book that you can go on. But there's also online many of Dzogchen's talks about it. But it's interesting to note that in our courtyard, that circle that has hexagrams in it, those are the hexagrams of the five modes, or the five ranks. And it was on that circle that the table was set, where Hozan signed the contract to be abbot 4 years ago. So when we say perspectives on the one reality, it is a play of what the relationship is between what we call the relative and the absolute, or this wonderful book calls it, this is Ross Pollard, the contingent and the essential. We call it form and emptiness. I mean, each one of those dialectics are problematic, including that it's a dialectic, because they're not equal. The emptiness includes everything, so it includes the relative. So it's not like there's this over here and that over there. The first two modes are called the inclusive modes. meaning that it talks about the relationship between the two. And the first one is the relative within the absolute, or the contingent within the essential, or form within emptiness. The second one is the opposite, is absolute within the relative, and so forth. The way I've been picturing that and keeping that in mind as a practice is that when we use this form, all of these forms come into this form, this Zendo form, and we sit Zazen, and someone slips into Shikantaza, and then other people follow, and then what's happening is Shikantaza in the room. That's form inside of emptiness. Just playing with the idea. And then when we go out on the porch and the world looks new, it looks lucid, luminous, and there's a green you've never seen before in a leaf. You're seeing emptiness in multiple forms. You're seeing emptiness embedded in form. The second two, third and fourth, are called the exclusive modes. Meaning there's an attempt, which is not actually possible, it's kind of a thought experiment, to look at just emptiness, the experience of just emptiness. And then the experience of just being in the world, just being in the marketplace, and then the nitty-gritty in the work. All of these modes contain both. So it is a bit of, you know, it's asking for a bit of imagination, but that's fine. The closest I can get to feeling into that, what mode three is, which is the kind of pure experience of emptiness, and let me stop here and say that embedded in this teaching is also an idea that it's impossible to talk about. You know, there's the line in the Jewel Mirror of Samadhi that says, Baba, wah, wah, is anything said or not, because words fail. So as soon as I try to approach describing this, I'm feeling like my words will not come up to the experience that I've had. And that, I think, is true. Think of the words as pointers, because it is of not possible to actually represent in words. But it's also the only thing we have. So, a year or two ago, drove to the Humboldt Redwoods to go camping with my stepdaughter and granddaughter and family. And these days, I go well-armored. I had a camper truck. My 40-year-old self would be very disdainful of that, but it is what it is, you know, and I was happy. And so I'm surrounded by a fair amount of metal and form. And I arrive on the Avenue of the Giants at night and find the campsite, and the minute I was in that area, whatever is there permeated, whatever armor that was, you could feel the presence. When I got out of the vehicle, at the campsite. It was completely dark and completely silent. You couldn't see individual trees, which is why we think of emptiness as darkness, which is the illumination of those boundaries, right? And there was presence. Which is that line in the poem, I come into the presence of still water. It's like that. There's a word I picked up in an article I read in a literary magazine. The word is Sila or Sila, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's S-I-L-A. It's an Inuit word. And depending on the context, it means, if I can get without reading, state of mind, sky, weather, breath, consciousness, universe. You want to hear that again? State of mind, weather, sky, breath, consciousness, and universe. I mean, it is my feeling that that's what we're trying to capture when we say emptiness. I'd be interested in what you think, too. So, mode four. Is where I linger. Mode four is entering the marketplace, entering the world without a thought about emptiness or Sila or whatever. And working one's enlightenment path through the work on karma. So, the metaphor that came leaping to mind is a river metaphor. So, some of you know that one of the things that I have done for a long time is run rivers, white water rivers, and flat water rivers in many states. And one of the things that you do when you come to a rapid, which is a pay attention moment in a river, particularly a big rapid, and rapids are categorized by the rank, they are ranked. Most rivers are 1 to 5, the Colorado is 1 to 10. And always the rapid that comes to mind when I think of a really big rapid, it's Lava Falls and the Colorado, which is the 10. It's a quarter mile long and it gorges up and goes through lava. And it is a maelstrom of big water. And what you do when you come to a place like that, and even no matter how experienced the river guides are, you park your boat at the top and you do this thing called scouting, which means you walk down as far as you can go beside the river to look at what's happening, and particularly as you go down you're looking at what the hazards are. You know, you don't want to go there because you'll get stuck in a rock garden and nobody will read the rest of you. You don't want to go there because the boat will flip. You don't want to go there because boat will wrap on a rock. So you look at the hazards as you go down. when you're at the bottom, you say, that's where I want to end up. And then you walk back up and say, what do I have to do to get there? And then once you're at the top, there's several things to do. For me, there was always something to do, which is to manage myself. Because now I have scared myself, and I have to figure out how to calm myself down. And one of the things that I picked up randomly was in a dojo someplace that Eastern martial arts teaches you to throw your energy into your feet. And Westerners tend to throw their energy into their arms and head. And that causes you not to be able to think very well, be off balance. And so I would do a tree pose, or I'd do what I could to ground out the energy that I just accumulated. One time when we were standing at that point in Lava Falls, my bow paddlers turned to me and she said, so the path that you've just looked at is what I'll call plan A. She turned to me and she said, this is a plan B rapid. And there's several important things about that. One is that when you're looking down on a river, it looks completely different than when you're looking at it, you know, level. And so you have to actually figure out how to transpose the view. So there's that, figuring out where you are once you're moving. And the other thing is that the river is predictable and random at the same time. You can predict that there's going to be a wave in a particular place, but you can't predict whether it's going to break back on you. That's random. So no matter what you think is going to happen, the river may have other ideas about it. And so once you are in that slot and you're moving and plan B happens, the river teaches you another lesson, which is let go, plan A. Let go, don't even think about it again, because if you're all caught up with woulda, coulda, shoulda, the river will slap you with the next thing. So by the time you are at the bottom, you may have managed your way through plan A, B, C, and D, whatever. And if you're upright, well done, regardless of what plan it was. And in fact, if you're not upright and you get rescued, well done. And if you're at the bottom and you rescue someone else, well done. It is what it is. And actually, if you have to be rescued or you rescue somebody, then you have a really good story to tell. You know, let's tell stories about the plan A that worked. I mean, we have what I would call a plan B, C, D sushi. And I regret that I was part of the hazards that created plan B and C and D. But what happened, actually, I think was better than plan A. Because I think the talk that was given the day I was supposed to give this talk was better than the talk, than this talk would have been. I think it was more in tune with what was happening. And so she was just, like, just right. And there is a way in which what happens is just right. So the mode four, I guess, is where we figure out how to find the appropriate response in the world. Where we find our own brokenness and the brokenness of the world and practice in the mud, as it were, in the dusty road. Those are metaphors for this practice. The fifth mode is mysterious and hard to describe, and I'm probably not the right person to describe it. I have modest glimpses of it that I, but it is the complete unification, merging of the two, so that one's appropriate action just emerges, apparently, seamlessly, and without reference to relative and absolute. Dogen calls it without a trace. So I've been thinking about this as ways that we traverse the world through these modes at any given time. We find Buddha in Shikantaza, we find Buddha in the luminosity of the world. We find Buddha in the still water, in the silence of the rivulets of presence. We find Buddha in our struggle to find the appropriate response. One of the reasons I think this was so eye-opening and helpful one for me is that it felt integrating. It felt like this was a way that I could understand experiences I'd had in the wilderness and not keep them separate from my Buddhist world and Buddhist. It was like the feeling was like a, you know, that kind of dopamine hit pleasure that you get when you get the right jigsaw puzzle piece that fits in, you know, like, ah. Like, it's all they were having made. Maybe this is why Sojin could say, and when I sort of asked Sojin in my mind, what would you think about these times? And I hear him say, maybe you've heard him say this too, it has always been us. And I never really found that comforting. But I sort of do now. There is a timelessness. I mean, there is a refuge actually in getting oneself into a 2,500 year view perspective rather than just the last few weeks. It is, it isn't bad news. And using Greg's wonderful Ryokan poem, which he memorized, showing front, showing back, showing front, showing back, following the golden. Nirvana, samsara, nirvana, samsara. One reality. So, we're on a big river. And ahead of us are no doubt some no small number of big rapids. We are in this tender moment of sitting vigil. And we don't know what the new year brings. And I know that I want to hang on to the feeling of refuge. And I know that that is a clinging, it's a reifying. And that there will be a plan to eat, that's it, and so forth. And we will get fully immersed and wet in this journey. So, can we remind one another and ourselves, this is just one mode that we're in? No matter what we feel, there is another view of this reality. We can figure out, I'm counting on this, the act of trust, I'm counting on that it is possible not to be swayed by external circumstances and also pay attention. There will be grief. But there doesn't necessarily need to be an anticipation of grief. We can meet things when they happen. And I remember, no matter what is happening, that there's a backside.
Thank you very much, Mary, for such a beautiful and touching talk. That poem by Wendell Berry has been a good friend to me for a long time. I return to it a lot. And I want to thank you for using it kind of as the North Star of your talk. Things were woven together really well, and I was touched by a lot of things that you said. I think in one line of that poem, the day blind stars winking at us. And my thought is that they're winking at us when we can't see them too. So like one of the things I take from that beautiful poem.
Yeah, it's still there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you happen to know if Wendell Berry was a Buddhist? I don't think he was.
He's a very interesting man, though. Very interesting. Yeah, an ecologist, a farmer.
So,
thank you, Mary. That was a really beautiful talk. And I was really compelled by your description of Lava Falls. That was the edge of my seat. And I have a kind of literal-minded question about that. I really appreciate the discussion of plan A, plan B, and you said, you know, if you end up at the bottom and you're not upright, then somebody rescues you, great, or you end up at the bottom and you rescue somebody else, great. But what if you end up at the bottom and there's somebody else there and you can't rescue them, or somebody can't rescue you, and that's the end of you? And that's not so great, maybe, and because it seems, I mean, that happens in life, of course, but the fact that you choose to do this river run puts a different light on it to me. I mean, what is the responsibility about the extreme danger of running a class 10 river? I don't know. I just wonder if I think about that.
Good question. I was afraid. There was a river runner whose name escapes me right at the moment. Probably I'll think of it later, but I always thought of him as a bodhisattva. He did environmental work. He was the person who chained himself to a tree to keep the Stanislaus River from being flooded. And I was on a river with him where he was teaching us paddling and so forth. And he said, there's a phenomenon in a river where as water goes over a rock, as it's going downstream, it goes down and creates a flood of water coming back, and it creates a, what we call a recirculating hole. And some of them that will hold on to you. And so you have to learn how to figure out how to get out of them. And he said, if you find yourself there, open your eyes and be curious. You might never be there again. It was like as you were falling off the cliff, plucking the strawberry on the way down, you know, it has that combination of, I mean, the reason that I was on the river is it was an extraordinary way to feel alive. And fortunately, I never faced the circumstance, although it's a circumstance that we face anyway here. I mean, we're facing it now. So, I mean, that's one answer. This is not an answer, but it gives me a chance to tell another story about Lavafall, if you permit me. This last year, I've given up organizing trips and doing the rowing myself, so we did a charter. And on the charter was my granddaughter, who had a terrible time in high school. She just graduated. She barely graduated. She barely survived, actually, the pandemic high school experience. And I had to talk her into, I really arm wrestled her into this trip. I said, this will change your life. And we get to this rapid, and we're with what I consider to be the best rower, and with us is Colleen. And the three of us are in the bow, and the best rower kind of gets through all of the rough stuff and then comes up on this house-sized rock that has a wave and water, and usually you come up like this and you go like that, and it happened to break. And so we didn't go like this, we went like this. It was the first and only time that I have flipped in a boat. And we all came up, and the first thing I felt was somebody grabbed the back of my life jacket, and all I could think of was, this person's gonna climb up me, and I barked like, oh. And then I turned around, and it was my granddaughter saving me. She was holding onto the upside down boat. And when we're all rescued and we're all up, she went like this. This is the best day of my life. And now she wants to be a river guide. She's working on that. So that's why. It saves, you know, people have, their lives have been turned around by being in wilderness. And that's the risk of being in wilderness, is that things happen. Since you're back there, Ellen, and then come down to Preston.
Thank you, Mary. And like you, I also find refuge in nature and in the redwoods. But I wondered if you'd say a few words about how you find refuge at the corner of Martin Luther King and University of Alabama.
Well, can I say how I find refuge driving in traffic instead? No? Okay. Well, I mean, it's similar. It is, there is a practice, I think it's a, I think I've heard come to say it's probably a Tibetan practice. This person, these other people like me, want not to be in pain. This person or these people around me, like me, want to be safe. That it is a kind of, that is actually what I try to do in practice. All of us are just trying to get home, or all of us are just trying to get where we need to be. That, you know, some way of expanding the personal agenda to include everyone around. And that helps me. Resting on that, Susan.
Mary, could you remind me the line in the Wendell Berry poem about that emotional tax of...
Yeah. I come into the presence of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief.
I'm wondering what you think about, like, might there be a sense in which fear of any variety is always or almost always anticipatory?
Mm.
Like, are the things we're afraid of, are they usually things that we're afraid will happen or might happen? Things that have not actually arrived here yet? And if or when those things that we're afraid of, when they do happen, the fear is like replaced with the need to essentially respond. So, you know, the fear of losing somebody, or the fear of being criticized. Yeah, I'm wondering if that sounds right to you, and if fear does tend to be anticipatory, then what do I do with that?
Well, a couple of things come to mind from my own experience. I have a tendency, I've had a tendency to do catastrophic thinking. And that is the projecting oneself into a fully catastrophic circumstance, regardless of what the current circumstances are. So it feels to me like pulling back from that, letting go of that actual visual imagery is an important part. The fear may still be there, but that's a different fear than that catastrophic projection. It is such a body reaction. It has also been helpful for me to know that the neurotransmitters that are involved in fear and anxiety are the same as those involved in excitement, and the differences in interpretation. So sometimes what I've done is take that visceral feeling and say, is this excitement or is this fear? Or, you know, play with that a bit. And the last is, long ago, someone said, fear may be there, but don't let it stop you. It's so coming into the room and preparing myself to give this talk, I felt anxiety. And when I was waiting in the community room, I started, well, I went through several things. One is, I'm gonna throw myself into the House of Buddha. That's who this is about, that kind of feeling. And the other thing I thought, I imagined was, this anxiety, this is a part of myself that is trying to keep me safe. And it's ego-oriented. And how can I take care of it? How can I take care of her? How can I let her be and accompany me, but not be driving the bus, so to speak, right? So sometimes I have to like peel her hands off the steering wheel. And sometimes it's easier. This time it was a bit easier because I don't know why it was. But.
Do you remember how your anxiety transfigured as you sat down at your seat and began your talk?
That presumes a transformation. It's still there.
Mary, we have two hands raised, and there's a comment in the chat. It says, Mark Dubious River Keeper.
Say that again.
It says, Mark Dubious River Keeper.
Mark Dubious a River Keeper.
Mark Dubious River Keeper. Lynn put that in the chat. But whatever that means. We have a raised hand from the BGC community room. And also a hand from Ken. So, community room, go ahead.
I get in the frame. Hi, Mary. I guess I just wanted to share my experience of anticipatory grief a little bit. When my mother had a long and difficult tail to her life, tail end to her life, about 5 months, I had a lot of anticipatory grief. And it was very difficult. And it also was the way my system had of grappling with and processing this event. I'd never lost my mother before, and I've never lost another mother. You know, this is it was a unique experience that I'm sure it would be different if I, and will be different other losses as I perhaps grapple more with the great matter, but I also feel like it's just, I tend towards anxiety, and I found that practicing with it, it's important not to manage those feelings away, and also to ground myself and give them space so that they are not driving the bus, not the only thing going on, not who I think I am. And also, they are a fact of my brain, oftentimes. It's just gonna happen. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm so sorry, Katie. You're absolutely right. I mean, I apologize if I implied that somehow we should wash away the anticipatory grief and it shouldn't happen. I think it absolutely is part of life and part of knowing how one feels. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Ken.
Kind of on the same theme, but when you were talking about catastrophizing, which usually we think we want to avoid that, but I think sometimes it can the opposite can be helpful. You can be in a kind of dicey situation, and sometimes I think, well, what is the worst thing that can happen out of this? And sometimes that can be strangely freeing. You've just sort of hit rock bottom there. And for example, if you're in a difficult situation, but you're saying, well, I'm not going to die here, or this is, I'm still going to blah, blah, blah. You're sort of looking at things from the ground up. There's no place else to fall. And sometimes that can give you a refreshing perspective, like, oh, okay, now where do we go from here? Instead of sort of brushing it away. So it's just like a flip. It's not like one is better than the other, but sometimes the alternative tack can, and maybe that's like throwing yourself into the Buddhist refuges or whatever you were talking about there. It's just a thought.
No, I think I appreciate it. It's scouting the river and letting you know what the hazards are, right?
Anyway, thank you very much.